Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You're tuned in to Modus Operandi. War is a racket. Smedley Butler, one of the most decorated Marines and two-time Medal of Honor recipient, said in his famous speech, it rakes in billions of dollars, hand over fist, for the few, that is. But what about the economics of peace? Could peace actually prove to be more profitable? Besides, obviously, being more sustainable. Tonight, we'll talk with famed economics professor Richard Wolff about the economics of peace. All right, let's get into the MO. James Takelet Jr. was paid a salary package of about $18.1 million in 2021. That's par for the course in his field of employment. His salary is roughly 164 times the median salary of his employees. Relative to the net sales of the company that he runs, that amount, totaling $66 billion in 2022, Jim's salary is mild and pales in comparison. James Takelet Jr. is the chairman, president, and CEO of Lockheed Martin, the head honcho of one of the world's leading defense contractors. His company's specialty is building jets and bombs and things that destroy human life. And Jim is just one of a handful of defense executives who some might call the merchants of death. So we know this industry rakes in big bucks. But more and more, people are starting to do the math on how much money peace brings. Peace, stability, cooperation, all that kumbaya stuff now has some data behind it. So to help us break down all the dollars and common sense that peace brings prosperity to all, we'll talk to Emeritus Professor of Economics at UMass Amherst, co-founder of Democracy at Work, Professor Richard Wolff. I should also add that the professor now has a radio show program called Economic Update. Very fitting. Professor Wolff, good to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. So we often talk about how much money the U.S. spends on war. The DOD gets nearly $1 trillion annually. We know this, and we'll discuss that later. But what many people don't realize is that economic prosperity and peace are inextricably tied. So according to a 2022 study by the World Bank and the Institute for Economics and Peace, GDP growth is steadily higher in more peaceful countries. Iceland took home the 2022 prize for the most peaceful country. But the researchers cautioned that this trend is not causal. Rather, it shows that peace and economic progress are actually interlinked. Can you help explain that for us?
Sure. It's a truism among economists who've studied economic history that the number, the GDP, the economic output of goods and services per year in an economy and its growth over time are not by themselves all that significant in terms of how a society evolves. Many, many other things come into play other than the sheer size of output. And so it isn't surprising at all that it might be that if you have an economy that's very large, like the United States, but that it has a disproportionate impact or commitment, if you like, to producing military goods and services, a big defense budget, as you quite rightly put it, that this may take away from innovation in lots of industries. It may mean that you keep producing a narrow band of goods, airplanes, guns, bullets, and all of that, rather than attending to all kinds of other issues that kind of get less investment or less energy or less research and development focus. So in the end, you might regret that you spent as heavily as the United States does on military activity because you neglected others that had a bigger impact on the eventual rate of growth itself. That has happened before in history, and that is happening now too. And we could go through, if you like, the mechanisms by which this enormous impact of spending on military can have very negative effects on your rate of growth and the development of your whole society.
Yes, sure. Why don't you give us one example so us non-economists can better understand?
Okay. Let me give you a stark example. Here's a statistic to think about. More people in the United States died during the COVID-19 pandemic of the last 3 or 4 years than died in World War I, II, and III in terms of American casualties in those wars. In other words, were we to have had foresight, we didn't, of course, but were we to have foresight, we could have spent a very small amount of the money we spent on military in all those wars to develop a really first-rate medical system in this country that could have right away responded with the ventilators and the masks and the gloves and all of the well-known apparatus of a well-developed medical system for the mass of people. We didn't do that, but it would have been a small reduction in our defense, as we call it, for a much better benefit in terms of saving lives, saving illnesses, saving the long COVID outlays that we're going to be having for years to come that are all holding back our economic development, not pushing it forward. And that's the kind of where you're looking at the quality of the outlays of a society. If you put all that much in defense, as people have long understood, that's where the old gambit, it's butter or guns that you invest in. Well, it could also be guns versus medical care, having a comprehensive health system everywhere in this country. We still don't have it. It's a travesty. We could have had it. A small cut in the defense outlays would have made that possible. And there are many other examples quite like that.
According to the Global Peace Index 2022 report, countries tend to deteriorate much faster than they improve. The report also revealed that the global average of peace dropped by 0.03% in 2022. All right, that may sound tiny, just a fraction of a percent, but that actually marked the 11th drop in 14 years. Is that reflected in what appears to be the state of the world economy right now, which you've explained to me just a few months ago, that we are now beyond the inflation phase and we're now in stagflation?
Well, here's how I would put it. I think I want to say yes, but I want to be clear about what I'm saying yes to here. We are now in a situation where the most arresting statistic about how the world has developed over the last, let's say, 20 years, just to pick a round number. That statistic, the most impressive one for many of us, is the level of inequality. In other words, to put it bluntly, the rich have gotten richer and the poor have not. And the gap between the rich, let's call it the top 5%, the top 10% if you want, and everybody else, has gotten wider. We didn't have to do it that way, but that's the way global capitalism has evolved, both here in the United States and pretty much everywhere else in the world, some more extreme than others. But the trend towards greater inequality seems to be built in to the capitalist system. There's a famous French economist named Thomas Piketty, written very important books over the last few years, and he works it all out, how that inequality tendency is built into the system. Why do I stress that? Because if we know anything about the history of the world, the more unequal societies are, two things happen. the mass of people who get poorer become upset, angry, bitter about what's happening to them. At the other side, the rich, by the very distance between themselves and the mass of people, become more anxious about their security, more aware that the majority of people don't have what they have and are looking enviously in their direction. So they want more police protection. They want more military protection. They are more suspicious, anxious, worried. Well, this is a tinderbox. It just then takes a little match thrown by whoever might be inclined to do so, and these situations explode. And when they do, you have civil wars, you have bitter strife, you have social divisions. You know what you have? You have what you see in the United States more each week, and whether it's individualized in shootings or it's more social in a political dialogue, which seems to be a dialogue of the deaf, and you have tensions exploding around the world, I would argue that we are having less and less peace and more violence and conflict because we are basing ourselves on an economic system that produces the inequality that leads to those unhappy outcomes.
Coming up next, for many outside of the United States, America is the land of peace and opportunity. But according to the latest Peace Index research, where the old USA ranks might actually shock you. We'll discuss it when we return with Professor Richard Wolff. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
In Hinduism, we always believe that life is a full circle. There are always ups and downs.
India, before the British, was the richest nation with the highest GDP in the world. And why did the 100 years of British rule bring it to a dismal low of some 50th ranking or late 30th ranking?
India was not their property. They had no right to take my property, my idols, my gods.
They went to our public spaces, our sacred spaces of temples, and really violently pulled out these pieces.
In fact, the word loot also is a Hindi word, which has now got into the English dictionary. So quite tellingly, even the Hindi word loot has been looted into the English lexicon.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. Hollywood movies paint the U.S. as the land of milk and honey. And while it retains its first world status, the level of peace its citizens actually experience tells a different story. Professor Richard Wolff is back with us to discuss the image of the U.S. versus the reality on the ground. So, Professor, the Global Peace Index ranked the U.S. at number 129 on their list. We're darn near the bottom. Only a few places like Yemen and Syria ranked below the U.S. on the Peace Index. Now, this may not make a lot of sense to some of the international viewers who may think of the U.S. as it's depicted in these movies. While we may not have bombs, you know, falling out of the sky, the U.S. is an extremely violent society, which has a direct impact on our domestic economy. And if you look at where our tax dollars are going, $858 billion just this year to the Pentagon, that is up $100 billion more than last year's budget. According to nationalpriorities.org, they say the individual average American taxpayer paid $929 toward Pentagon contractors in 2021, which funds them for a whopping 18 days. But only $171 of our taxes went to K through 12 education, then $62 going towards nukes, but only $7 towards anti-homelessness programs. How do you read our economic investments so far?
Well, you know, the distribution of our tax dollars, like the distribution of the income all of us get as human beings living here, is affected by all kinds of issues. Fears about the future, worries, savings, put your kid through college, be able to afford a better home, a better car. The way we spend our money is shaped by many, many things. And every capitalist enterprise has long ago understood this and realized that if it's going to succeed, it has to create a solid basis in the population of people who want to buy whatever the particular company is, what it's selling. And that's why, for example, we have an enormous industry called advertising, where a company pays to have its logo, its picture, its products stuck in our faces wherever we turn all day, every day, to keep us connected to them. Well, the defense industries are no different from an industry that makes ice cream or software programs. The people who produce guns and ships and tanks and planes and missiles, they need to keep the buyer of what they sell glued to them. Well, it doesn't make much sense to put the missile out there on the TV screen. Most people wouldn't know what to do with it. It's not part of their daily lives. And the buyer, remember, is the government. Nobody else is allowed to even own most of those things, let alone buy them. So the government has to be willing to let itself be approached by the defense contractors to promote their wares. But that looks a little dicey too. So long ago, the defense producers understood they have to go behind the politician. They have to go to the mass of people to give them the feeling that you better support the government buying all the guns and missiles and keeping all those troops in all those bases, in all those countries. You have to maintain a sense, and there's no way of beating around the bush here. You have to create a sense of being at risk, of being in danger. For most of the 20th century, we were all told that the danger is socialism. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, we had to find a new one, and we did. Terrorism and terrorists. And we declared an endless war on terrorism with the same language that we had earlier used to declare an endless war against socialism. And when terrorism faded away, well, then we had Mr. Putin and Russia coming back for a second run. And we have Xi Jinping in China and the China threat. This is a country that has felt the need to produce in itself a notion of at-riskedness from violent external forces, because whatever else you think about it, it is a wonderful way to keep the people willing to spend the money, just as you laid it out, on defense in a way that almost no other country does. Let me remind everyone of a famous statistic. that's been true for at least half a century. The United States as a nation spends more on military defense than the 9 other countries that are in the top 10 combined. Let me say it again. We as a nation spend more on the military than the next 9, the second, the third, the fourth, all the way down to the 10th country in terms of total outlay. And let me be clear, those countries added up have many more people to defend than there are American citizens. China alone, which is one of those 9 countries. Indeed, China and Russia are in the 9 below us. All the rest of those countries are allies of the United States. So the overwhelming military dominance of the United States was offset, lest it make Americans say, well, let's take it easy. We have more than the other 9 combined. What are we so worried? Oh, no, no. We keep up the sense of endangerment all the time in a way no other society does, and we therefore fund and keep going the military enterprises of the country.
Brown University's Cost of War Project highlights how these war contractors in the U.S. manage to keep their backing from lawmakers. Big contractors like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Bay Systems, and a lot of others, they've spread their subcontracting and supply chains all over the country, which they then tout as creating jobs in that state. But as the Brown University researchers discovered, of the 20 states with economies most dependent on Pentagon contracts or military manufacturing, 14 of the 20 states experienced poverty rates at, on par with, or in many cases even higher rates than the national average. So what does that do to the argument that war is actually good for the economy?
It's a challenge to that argument, and as are many other challenges to that argument. Let me expand a little bit on it. We know from studying the military expenditure that over the last 50 years, a very remarkable reality. Every dollar spent on the military produces less in the way of new jobs than it did 5 years ago, even less than 10 years ago. In other words, the labor component of outlays on defense has been shrinking. And nobody should be much surprised. That's mainly because our military is more and more mechanized, more and more computerized, more and more robotized, so that you don't generate the kinds of job numbers you did maybe in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. You don't do that anymore, which helps explain why unemployment and so on are now more and more present in the high military spending. But there's a deeper problem here, which is very ideological and comes down almost to a question of economic literacy. If you ask the question of a worker or a voter or somebody being polled in the street, and you say, are you concerned that if the military budget is reduced, less money will come flowing into this area and there'll be fewer jobs? Now, of course, the answer is yes. If the only thing that happens is that we cut the military budget, then yes, we will reduce the flow of money into an area, and that's not going to be good for its economy. But no one in their right mind has ever suggested that you cut the military budget and don't do anything else. The whole point of saving money on the military, spending less on military activity, is to spend that money on something else more valuable to the people of the country, whether that be in improving our schools, improving our hospitals, improving our fill-in-the-blank, dealing with our lax infrastructure, as we're slowly trying to do, perhaps relieving young people of the debts that they have that hobble their future. The whole point would be to compare how many jobs would be lost if the military cut back versus how many jobs would be created with the alternative investments that could be made with the money not spent on the military. That would be the only honest way to talk about this. Unfortunately, the military corporations, the employers and the capitalists who make the guns, the planes, the missiles, they don't want this to happen. They don't want to lose the money flowing into their profits in order to build up schools, hospitals, or other things. That'll be money made by others. They're not interested in that. So they have been very interested in keeping the question absurdly narrow. Do you want Defense Department money coming into your district or not? And everybody answers that in the predictable way. But you can't use that as a basis for arguing that the people want it. It's because you've posed the question in an unfair, biased way to get the answer you're looking for.
Professor Richard Wolff, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to speak with you. And you can hear more from the professor at democracyatwork.info. Okay, there you have it. But I think you already knew. We don't need a PhD in anything to know that with peace comes prosperity. But corporate greed from the merchants of death aren't willing to give up their profits without a fight. So the question becomes, how to fight for peace peacefully. I'll let you ponder that one. That's going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.